Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Fake news isn't new, but it reached new levels during the 2016 election cycle and has serious civic organizations across the country concerned about the future of our democratic republic. If we do not share a common understanding, how do we have a conversation about what we need to achieve going forward? The League of Women Voters of Metropolitan Columbus has planned a forum on the topic of fake news for tonight. For more information, check out the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. And we'll hear from the League later on in the program. Joining us now is Deputy Editor of PolitiFact, Katie Sanders. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Also, Director of Overseas Partnership Programs at Stony Brook University's Center for News Literacy, Richard Hornick. Richard is a former editor and correspondent for Time Magazine and teaches an online course at Stony Brook entitled Making Sense of the News, News Literacy Lessons for Digital Citizens. Welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
Richard Hornick, there's nothing new about fake news. You've said that fakery is as old as truth, right? Obviously, technology has changed. What about the consumers of news?
Well, that's the big problem. In fact, you're absolutely right. Fake news is as old as the hills. What's changed in the last decade is the way we get our news. And you mentioned this, the need for a common understanding to have a conversation. Well, we had that for 40 or 50 years. We had three TV networks. We had, Time Magazine, Newsweek, some big newspapers in every city, and there was a real sort of mainstream conception of what was important and what the facts were. And over the last 10 or 20 years, the proliferation of first cable and now all the different social media channels has made it possible for people to find the news they want, as opposed to the news that editors think that they should be getting. And I think that's the real problem. It's the consumer that needs to be retrained for, as we call it, a new literacy for the 21st century.
Is there a difference between just reading the news that you agree with, seeing the news that you want, and fake and finding it in fake news?
Well, if fake news is most people, I think, know when something is fake deep down inside, but they like it because it agrees with their point of view. And, this is, again, as old as the hills. Back 40 or 50 years ago, before consolidation began, if you lived in New York City, there were 12 newspapers, and if you were an Irish stevedore on the Lower East Side, there was a paper that, pretty much, spoke to your worldview. I think fake news is just it's a fad. It's sort of the flavor of the month. Margaret Sullivan of the Washington Post wrote a great column back in early January saying we should just stop talking about fake news, because once you sort of stigmatize information that way, then anything you disagree with becomes fake. this is what President Trump is doing all the time. If he doesn't like it, he just says it's fake. And a lot of what's wrong in journalism is, going to the mainstream outlets, a lot of what people call fake news is just bad journalism, sloppy journalism. What we've been trying to do for the last decade here at Stony Brook is develop a curriculum to train people to spot bad journalism to demand good journalism. People always say, in a democracy you get the government you deserve. Well, we believe that in the 21st century, you get the information you deserve. And if you don't want to pay anything, and if you just want stuff that agrees with you, then you're going to get, crappy information.
Katie Sanders, tell us about PolitiFact, its origins, why it was founded, and what it's become.
Oh, thank you. PolitiFact was founded back in 2007, originally just to fact-check the 2008 presidential election. We had always covered the presidential election here at the Tampa Bay Times and the St. Petersburg Times, but we had an editor who had covered many, many races and was tired of reporters kind of doing the he said, she said, or he said approach to their news reporting and just kind of propagating false claims without directly challenging them. And even though the reporters, when they were covering these claims, they would just repeat them. But they wouldn't, in their news reports, but they wouldn't feel like it was fair to actually call them out and say what the senator said was incorrect. And 10 years ago, that felt biased in a way, even though you were just calling out the truth. Mm-hmm. So we came up with, at the Tampa Bay Times, we came up with the Truth-O-Meter, which evaluates politicians' statements on a sliding scale from true to half true, all the way down to pants on fire, crazy, ridiculous, false. And we're able to, you know, we go about our reports just like we're all journalists. We interview subjects and we dig into research. And then we come up with a rating that reflects the accuracy of the claim. So it's a little lighthearted, but we take it very seriously, if that makes sense.
How many people do you have working on this?
We have, people are always surprised when I say our staff is about 10 people.
Wow.
Between offices in Washington and St. Petersburg and a few other places as well, with people working remotely. So that's a good-sized staff. We feel like we can cover a lot of ground, but when you're talking about the statements coming out of the White House and the statements coming out of Congress, and now we have this onslaught of fake news that has so much reach, we're not overextended, but we're very busy.
And you made the distinction of fake versus false earlier. What is the distinction in your mind, Katie Sanders?
Well, I think people are fake is kind of a trendy word now. So false is something that is just not accurate, but it's not necessarily just made up for malicious reasons. Fake is just somebody just making something up. I think people, there could be a false statement that is maybe when somebody is misremembering something, it's still false, but it's not necessarily fake. But I promise we don't get into that kind of wonky discussion in our fact check.
Mm-hmm.
Time I thought about it.
But you do the liar, liar, pants on fire, you do the pants on fire, which of course is the riff on the liar, liar part.
Exactly. A lot of our fake news stories, we've done a lot of them this year, they often get a pants on fire rating, but not always. Sometimes they get a false or a mostly false rating because we find that some of these bloggers take real news events and are inspired to riff on them. And sometimes they say they're parody sites. A lot of the times they don't. But they're taking kernels of truth and just blowing out of proportion, like you said, to appease the reader or the listener. Because that's something that sounds plausible, but you know, isn't actually what the original story said.
And Richard Hornick, we made passing reference to the technology, but that's a very viable part of this equation. It's a very important part because you can make things look super legitimate online. Back in the day, I mean, to produce a newspaper would have been difficult to compete with your everyday mainstream newspaper.
Yeah, I mean, I tell my students that back in the 70s, a bunch of people in New York put together a fake version of the New York Times called Not the New York Times. It took, you know, dozens of people months, and, you know, basically one of my students could probably do it in an afternoon now. So what we have this, we say that, you know, the digital news consumer faces four big challenges. One is the speed versus accuracy. Everybody's trying to be first, and that's always been true, but the digital revolution has made that worse. Another big one is authenticity, and that's what you're talking about here. How, you know, you can make things look authentic that really aren't. Another one is the blurring of the lines. You know, what used to be clearly news is now maybe sponsored content, is then who knows what. And then the last one is what I was referring to before. It's sort of, you know, the confirmation bias, people just, you know, wanting to hear what they want to hear. I went just back briefly to mm-hmm. fake versus false.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a matter of intent.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, Katie makes a great point. It's you know, sometimes people are doing it on purpose. Sometimes they just slip. I think what's really changed now, and I think this creates a real problem for even mainstream media, is that in the olden days, you know, when I was a journalist, if you caught somebody saying something false, there was at least a bit of chagrin.
Mm-hmm.
Today, there's no shame whatsoever, and so people will come on NPR, for example, the White House security aide Sebastian Gorka. And he will say things that are flat out not true, and he probably knows they're not true. But the person interviewing him in real time, Steve Inskeep, isn't, you know, maybe an expert in that thing. And so these these falsehoods can get these this fake news can wind up in the middle of mainstream media, and I don't think people are you know, the mainstream media is really fully equipped to do this. You know, CNN has started to put on their chyrons at the bottom, you know, not true when people say things. But, you know, PolitiFact is great after the fact, but there's so much going on in real time that it's I think that's the bigger challenge, not the volume, but just the fact that it's happening in real time all the time.
Yeah, the 24/7 news cycle. And the likes of Sebastian Gorka, I mean, when he's talking, I heard that same interview and was I almost missed a movie sitting in my car with my jaw on the floor listening to that. And but completely understanding, given the role that I play, that that can happen.
Yeah, I would argue that in this case, and I think, you know, we can have this as a separate conversation, but that when you have somebody like that, then it behooves the news outlet to have someone there who is his equal. So if Mary Louise Kelly, for example, had been doing that interview, he would not have gotten away with that. She would not have let him get away with that.
Right.
So, you know, but that's a discussion for another day.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of part. I think you bring up the valid point of the 24/7, which makes me ask Katie Sanders, how in the world do you keep up with just 10 people? How do you vet what you're going to fact check?
Well, we do have, I think that's one of our priorities, is to respond to falsehoods as soon as they come out. But we don't often have an ability to measure these claims instantly because we do have a small staff. We kind of cover a lot of topics. We only have one reporter who truly specializes on one beat, and that's immigration. But even then, these claims require a lot of interviews, a lot of going back to the source who made it, asking for information. It can take 1 to 2 days. The good part in an election that we found is falsehood, and I think you saw this with President Trump, kept repeating the same falsehoods. So in those cases, we were able to respond in an instant. But he made a great point that it's really hard to get something out of the public consciousness. And this also comes back to fake news. These claims are not hard to debunk. Mm-hmm. They don't take a full day. They take maybe an hour to really write up and then decide on the rating. And maybe a little bit longer once you figure out there's more to it than that. And we're finding that we're able to respond to fake news claims a lot faster than an interview that Donald Trump may have given or whoever else. But there's still, once it's out there, we call it, it's like a bad weed. It just spreads very quickly, and it's hard to get out.
We're talking about fake news today. You just heard from Katie Sanders. She's deputy editor of PolitiFact down in Florida. Also with us, Richard Hornick. He's director of overseas partnership programs at Stony Brook University Center for News Literacy. He teaches a course on news literacy. It's called Making Sense of the News, News Literacy Lessons for Digital Citizens. More coming up. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about not only the proliferation of fake news, but how it's changed how we think and act and what we do to filter out the fiction from the fact. The League of Women Voters of Metropolitan Columbus has planned a forum on the topic of fake news for tonight. For more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll hear from the League later on in the program. Still with us is Deputy Editor of PolitiFact, Katie Sanders, and also Journalism Lecturer and Director of Overseas Partnership Programs at Stony Brook University's Center for News Literacy, Richard Hornick. I wanted to talk a little bit about your class, Making Sense of the News, News Literacy Lessons for Digital Citizens. You know, did news literacy issues, I mean, for me, they started to emerge back, I don't know, 15 or I don't maybe 10 years ago when I was a columnist. And I would get calls from people saying, why do you think you can just say what you think about something? Your article wasn't balanced. And I said, well, I'm a columnist. I'm an opinion columnist. I'm not a news reporter. And it made me start to wonder, do people even understand how a conventional newspaper is set up, or and does that lack of understanding spread to even worse in the digital era?
Oh, you've really hit the nail on the head. In fact, this course was created by Howard Schneider, who used to be the editor of Newsday, and then created a journalism school here at Stony Brook about 10 years ago. And he began teaching the course, and he quickly realized that there was no point in training quality journalists if nobody understood what quality journalism was.
Hmm.
And so our course that we teach to undergraduates here, which is just called News Literacy, and is now taught in about 20 universities, both here and overseas. We're in Vietnam and Poland and Russia. It's all about exactly what you just described. You know, how should journalism work? What should it really look like? How can you tell, you know, when it's opinion, when it is an opinion, good opinion from bad opinion? You know, the old Daniel Moynihan line, everyone's entitled to their own facts, but not their own opinions, but not their own facts.
Right.
And so, that was the beginning of this. And then, you know, the digital era was making it more and more intense, but social media has just put the whole thing on steroids. And so what we're doing, we're trying to approach the problem in a few different ways. First of all, we have this undergraduate general education course that we, you know, have taught over 15,000 students here and around the world, taken it. We're also working to get it into middle schools. There's a middle school in Coney Island that teaches news literacy an hour a week to all of their students. We're doing stuff at the high school level. And the MOOC, this online course on Coursera that you mentioned, Making Sense of the News, is our attempt to get it before, you know, the masses. And right now we have 5,000 enrolled learners. We just started in January, so we're pretty happy with that. It's a 6-week course. It's free. We're getting some support from Facebook now. They're giving us some ads for that.
Yeah.
And Coursera is going to start pushing it a little bit more. So there are many different ways of going about it, but it's exactly what you just said. It's, you know, what should good information look like? The goal of our course is to have people be able to find reliable, actionable information. It used to be just in journalism, but now anywhere.
Yeah, and it used to be just a matter of turning to that page in the newspaper. It was very easy to understand
mm-hmm.
if you grew up with it. But so many
mm-hmm.
people, particularly digital natives, they didn't even grow up with the newspaper on the kitchen counter in the morning.
Well, and you know, frankly, I'm sorry. I also think that the journalism world has done a terrible job of explaining these things. There's a certain arrogance. We all know
mm-hmm.
that there was a Chinese wall between the news people in your paper
mm-hmm.
and the op-ed page, the editorial page. I mean, the readers don't understand that. We all knew that, you know, if a candidate was endorsed by a newspaper, that didn't mean that their actual news coverage would be slanted towards that person. But most people don't really know that. The New York Times thinks that if they run a story that has somebody's name on it or a picture or is ragged right instead of flush right, that means that everyone knows that that's analysis or opinion. Nobody knows that.
Right.
So I think, you know, the business has done a pretty bad job of explaining how we do things and what our standards are to people.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about fake news today, why it matters. What do you think? Does it matter? And how hard do you work to avoid it or to filter it out? 614-292-8513. And Christopher in Cincinnati, you bring up an issue that I wanted to bring up, so join the conversation. Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Hello. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I did want to agree with just the very last comment. Yes, journalists are doing a terrible job of explaining anything today. But in point of today's conversation,
mm-hmm.
I think neglecting the effect of Citizens United and the overwhelming control of media by conglomerates completely neglects the root of the problem. When news can be controlled by a handful of corporations, and then the political process can be flooded with whatever information they wish to distribute, we can't continue to act like things are the same as they ever were.
Katie Sanders, how do you suss through things when it comes to that and what Christopher is saying?
Well, I think, Christopher, I understand your concerns, but from my experience, journalists have a real independent streak. And this idea that assignments or focus or really heavy-handedness comes from the top down isn't true for a lot of journalists that I know. And I can tell you that at PolitiFact and the Tampa Bay Times, we're actually independent. We are just owned by the Times, which is owned by this journalism college called the Poynter Institute. I don't experience that, and we approach our own journalism with a real independent streak where we make all of the decisions about what to cover, and we make those decisions based on what we think people are wondering about or confused about. I get your concerns.
You know, Katie Sanders, I mean, obviously the Tampa Times and PolitiFact and the Poynter Institute, that's the exception.
I mean, it is, but I do have to say, based on the peers I have in the industry, I think people could benefit from more exposure to journalists, mm-hmm. more conversation, because everything that we said in the previous segment is true, where people don't understand the difference between a story and a column. And it's so easy for us to write that off. But people, this isn't entirely new that people aren't understanding the information that looks like an article that is presented before them. And I think that leads to a lot of confusion with people falling for fake news and not being able to tell the difference between phony accounts that look real and real accounts that's on Twitter. And that also goes for any story. So I'm all about news literacy, improving that so that people can have stronger trust in the media again.
Richard,
don't have all the answers.
Okay. Yeah, Richard Hornick?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. And in fact, I think one of the issues isn't the sort of concentration of power. I think it's the diffusion of power. I mean, the digital revolution has made everybody a publisher. Every one of my students has a TV station in their hip pocket. You know, it's called a smartphone. And so there's this proliferation of views, and in fact, the issue seems to be more one of the consumer not demanding better information. They'll get what they want, and that's why we're trying to teach them or help people understand, the difference between not just an opinion piece and a reported piece, but sponsored content and a real news story. And I think, again, if the more people demand this, the more they'll get. So I view this much less as a supply side problem than a demand problem.
Right. I mean, what about the accusations that were out there that one of the reasons why candidate Donald Trump he was good for the ratings. It didn't matter what he said. He was good for the ratings. More people tuned into those debates than they ever expected would, because Donald Trump was there and he was talking, and no one thought, or I shouldn't say no one, but a lot of people didn't think he would win. So what difference did it make what he said?
Well, American journalism has always been this strange amalgam of public service and for profit. We've always been driven by making money, mm-hmm. and that's how it's always worked. And sometimes it works better than others. I think one of the issues that we have right now, especially people of my age anyway, is, there's this tendency to view the past and these sort of halcyon days, and maybe they were, but, it was a pretty brief period in American history, mm-hmm. when we had responsible mainstream media that were just pumping out. We had the yellow press. Back in the late 19th century, let's just say journalism has a sort of checkered past, mm-hmm. and you know, yes, CNN completely, you know, went overboard on this, and they could have been more responsible, but I don't think it would have made that much difference at the margins. But again, you know, if we can get people to, you know, understand that they're not getting good information, then they'll go some other place. You know, one of the big problems facing journalism now, and one of the reasons you get a lot of this sponsored content and all this other stuff, is that the business model broke down 20 years ago. The advertising-based business model broke down, and now we've got to try to find ways to get people to come and pay for this stuff, or get millions of eyeballs, which is why you have that, you know, that clickbait and sponsored content stuff, even on respectable news sites. So, to a certain degree, I think we're going through a very, very difficult transitional period in the journalism world, and Donald Trump just happened to come along at this particular time, and also a time when, you know, there were a lot of serious problems in the United States that perhaps the mainstream media wasn't doing a very good job of covering in the first place.
You know, Katie Sanders, I was trying to think of how to put in context the number of people that work in PolitiFact, 10 reporters between the two, between Tampa and Washington. And I kind of thought of it when I was covering the Ohio State House. There was a bureau, Akron Beacon Journal, which doesn't even have a bureau here anymore in the State House. It used to have 5 reporters mm-hmm. covering just the State House in Ohio. Just to give people a think, and to add to what you were saying, Richard Hornick, is, you know, I was around in the Halcyon days when they were also well-funded and well-staffed, and that's a big difference. Mort in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mort.
How are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
My biggest contention on the facts is that there are no facts sometimes. When a reporter puts in their article, Mr. So-and-so saw Mr. B hit Mr. Abel, but Mr. So-and-so can't really speak because they're not authorized to speak on behalf of so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
That's a cop-out, in my opinion.
The unnamed source.
Name, get the facts and tell, say, you know, Mary Lynn, whatever name, she lives in Columbus, and she saw Mr. Baker hit Mr. Abel.
Mm-hmm.
Get the facts. And I contend that even if you're a day or two later, in an article, but you have more facts than anyone else, your news will be respected because those are facts that people can stand on, and the fake news people online cannot stand on that with their 2 feet because they don't follow the facts. See?
Well, let's hear. So, Katie Sanders, what about the unnamed source? How does that play out at PolitiFact?
We actually don't use unnamed sources at PolitiFact for that very reason. We list all of our sources on the side of articles so that people can read our stories and consult the primary sources to come to their own conclusions. But and we're also leery of relying too heavily on news stories about the White House, this White House or the previous one, that did rely on anonymous sources. So I think you make a really good point, Mark, that you know, there are some news organizations that have become too reliant on anonymous sources. I have to say, though, there's this culture of just a total lack of transparency when you're dealing with government sometimes, where the only way to get at the truth is to get something from an unnamed source and then try your best to corroborate it mm-hmm. with other sources. I mean, they genuinely are scared to lose their jobs, so I don't think that it's always a cop-out to rely on an anonymous source, but all kinds of things go into those decisions, such as, is the news that important that it needs to get out without direct attribution? That's one consideration. But I'll just repeat that at PolitiFact, we don't use anonymous sources because we do know that it puts your reliability and your credibility in question.
Richard Hornick, what about the unnamed sources, and what do we know about the proliferation of that?
Well, it's, you know, I was in Washington in the late 80s, and it was getting bad then, and it's gotten a lot worse. As Katie said, especially, you know, stuff coming out of the White House, I think they're completely abused, and Mark is absolutely right. I mean, when I ask my students, what's the matter with an unnamed source, their first response is, well, the reporter could have just made it all up. It's very difficult to argue with that. So what we teach is that when you see an unnamed source, and this is what you should demand, and we don't get enough of it, but when you see an unnamed source, there should be three things. That the reporter should be transparent about why the source isn't speaking. And Mark made a great comment about, you know, chose not to speak because they were not the person authorized. You know, that's baloney. That doesn't tell you anything. Anyway, so why are you giving them this unnamed status? How do they know what they know? Mm-hmm. And do they have any axe to grind? So if it's a story out of the White House saying Reince Priebus is in trouble, says one White House staffer, could you tell me if that's a White House staffer who happens to be part of, you know, Bannon's group? So, you know, and then, as Katie mentioned, corroboration. So no story should be based purely on an anonymous source. And when you do that, you get into big trouble. I mean, we just had the anniversary of the Janet Cook fiasco.
Oh, yeah.
And
from Washington Post, by the way.
Fun fact to know, do you know who her editor was?
No.
Bob Woodward. So
I'll say I was spawned from journalism school that year, and we had to go out and do man on the street interview type things and ask mm-hmm. people about that. And I was shocked at how many people then did not trust what they read in the newspaper because of that.
Exactly. So, I mean, you know, this is, again, journalism was doing great when you and I were, you know, in it, and it was tremendous. But, you know, it also got a little full of itself, and I think there was a tendency to try to tell a larger truth, and maybe you know, could cut a few corners to do that. And, I think, over that period, even before the business model collapsed, the credibility of journalists was going down because of those sorts of things. So, but again, you know, if people, you know, if the solution is not more ethics codes for journalists, it's mm-hmm. to have a well-informed consumer who demands better information.
Mort, thanks a lot for that call. Abdul in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Abdul.
Hi, how you doing? And thank you for my topic is this, like, there's no real journalism. And remember what happened, like the Obama. Like, no matter what he said, the truth or not, Fox always reports whatever they wanted. And now we got a president who won't even allow some journalism to ask him a question or to do whatever they wanted. So it seems like we lost what used to be a journalism. Journalism is, if you see in a newspaper, I'm from Africa. I'm from Somalia.
Uh-huh.
I've been born in Somalia, raised in Somalia. I came in this country. I live in Columbus. We have like 100,000 Somalian people, but nobody reported true about Somalia. All we hear about just like the problems. We never heard about the good things they did in this country. Like the north side used to be invested with the crime, gangs, and everything. And now the apartments are flourishing. There's a lot of supermarkets opening and things like that. But now it's like you report whatever you want. It's like you do whatever you want. It's not like the truth.
Well,
comment.
Abdul, I think you bring up a good point. I want to run up by our guest right now. Thank you so much for calling. Is that, you know, some people like Abdul quarrel with what journalists decide to cover in the first place. And does Richard Hornick, does that go back to understanding the role of the newspaper in the first place?
Yeah. In fact, one of the things we do, one of our favorite exercises with our students is called "You Be the Editor," and we give them 10 or 12 stories, and they, you know, everything from, you know, the serious to the frivolous, and we talk about these things called news drivers, you know, conflict, prominence, the immediacy, and those sorts of things. And we have the students at the beginning basically saying, you know, having the attitude that Abdul has, and then when we put them in charge, they make the same decisions that newspaper editors make, because, you know, you want people to read your paper. There are plenty of examples of, I think the Washington Post is still doing this, of, you know, efforts to just report good news in places. Well, mm-hmm. you know, I lived in communist countries where all we had was good news, and mm-hmm. it was, you know, those places didn't work out so well. And people are not drawn to good news. They're drawn to conflict. There's a reason why People magazine has a celebrity divorce on the cover every other week. Again, you know, it's this conflict that we have between a profit-driven and a public service in journalism, And that's probably not going to change anytime soon.
Well, I want to thank you both, Richard Hornick, Director of Overseas Partnership Programs at Stony Brook University Center for News Literacy. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I hope all of your listeners will take our online course and start demanding better information.
We'll post a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll also post a link to PolitiFact. Katie Sanders, thanks to you as well. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. I enjoyed the conversation.
Katie Sanders, Deputy Editor of PolitiFact, once again at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll have links to those. Coming up, we're going to hear from the League of Women Voters of Ohio about what their concerns are about all of this when we go forward with our Democratic Republic. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. In the last 2 weeks of the 2016 presidential campaign, fake news grabbed more audience than real news. That's according to an analysis by the news site BuzzFeed. Perhaps an equal, if not greater, cause of concern is that a 2016 study by Stanford University reveals that most young people cannot spot fake news. We're talking about the proliferation of fake news and how our changing modes of receiving news is changing the equation of what we know is true. The League of Women Voters of Metropolitan Columbus has planned a forum on the topic of fake news for tonight. For more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Joining us now is election specialist at the League of Women Voters of Ohio, Peg Rosenfield. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Peg, when did the League start to notice an issue with the whole fake news thing when it came to politics and elections?
Well, there's been some of it forever.
Right.
But I think mostly in the last couple of years. Fake news is why we do all our voter service information.
In the first place.
Yeah.
How many questions? So what does the League do for people who are questioning what they're reading in the newspaper or hearing on the TV or the radio? You don't do fact checking. What do you do?
No, we do understand how the election system, for instance, works. A number of us have worked in the election system. So we can explain to people how it works. And no, your election is not being stolen. Your votes are all counted. Yes, what you're hearing is not true. And it's perhaps I shouldn't say it brags a little. People believe us because we've been doing this since 1920.
Right, because fake news extends to the very fundamental properties of the election system
Itself
nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's in the news today. The same thing, you know, they don't believe the results of the Turkish election. Well, somehow that spills over into our elections, and we can assure people that there are mistakes that happen, but they're not stealing your election.
For me, it goes back to 2000 in Florida during the recount.
Yes.
And people, including myself, were startled by...
So was I.
How... messed up it was.
Yes.
We prided ourselves, didn't we, on
yes.
the best system in the world.
It was a mess. And there were all sorts of efforts that to fix it. And some of the fixes then had to be fixed. But we have learned a great deal since then. And technology has improved since then. And we really, people in the election system do learn from mistakes. And we really do have an excellent system with multiple protections in there.
Do you think that, well, what do you think has contributed to this eroding confidence in the system?
That gets to be almost philosophical. Just people don't trust anything much anymore, which is why I think what we do is very important. People really do trust us because we are truly nonpartisan. And if we provide this information on the candidates, on the issues, and it really does give all sides. We give the pros and the cons. We explain things so that we hope people can understand them. And we've been doing this for years. People are familiar with the Voter Information Guide, the VIB, that comes out with the newspaper. We have forums for candidates. We have information sheets on what you need to know to make sure that you've done everything right, so you're registered and you get and you vote. And people really appreciate that. We have a phone bank on election day.
Right.
And people call us up and ask us a lot of questions.
Like, what are they asking?
Well, they ask questions like, is my ballot really counted, my provisional ballot? Yes. They have to check that you are, in fact, registered if you vote provisional. But then they count your ballot. Will they count my absentee ballot? And for years I've said, yes. When you hear election results, election night, the first results you hear are the absentees. It is, you know, I know there's a rumor forever that they only count those in a close. No, they count them every year first.
Right off the bat.
Yeah.
That's what gives journalists something to talk about
exactly.
At 7 o'clock at night.
And but people call us because they know we don't have an axe to grind.
But have you noticed increased fears about this? Or not necessarily?
A little bit, but it's, I've been doing that phone bank forever, 40 years. And many of the questions are the same. They really are informational questions. People just want clear, honest information.
Does it hurt, or is it just, does everybody, when Donald Trump says that the election is rigged, do people really believe that?
Yeah, they must. Or they wouldn't be calling us and asking, essentially, is that true? And people stop me, acquaintances, and say, could they really do that? And they really, it's kind of flattering. They think I know all the details. That they really want to know, well, why, what keeps that from happening? How do I know that they didn't mess with my ballot, that I punched that thing on the touch screen. How mm-hmm. do I know they counted that way? And I said, because there's a paper trail.
There's a receipt, right.
There's a paper trail on there. And if there is any doubt, they can go back and look at that paper, which you can see. And if it doesn't match what the machine said, they've got a lot of explaining to do. And the same thing with people say, well, maybe the Secretary of State changed the votes. Well, you go to your county board of elections and they can show you what they sent to the Secretary of State. And then you see what the Secretary of State recorded, and they better match. And they do.
Last election cycle, and you might have even been here when some people called in to say, but why can't I take the receipt with me? Why can't I leave the voting booth with proof of how I voted? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's because it's against the law to sell your vote. And if you are selling your vote for whatever, $5, $50, the person who's buying your vote wants to be sure you voted the way they paid you to. And so they're going to want to see your vote to show that you voted that way.
For a lot of people, that sounds as much of like implausible. They don't from history, not even 40 or 50 years ago, that was happening a lot. People don't remember, though.
Well, I worked for 12 years in the Secretary of State's office, and we found people in a few counties who, in fact, are buying votes for $5 and a pint of whiskey.
Would they expect that you'd take a picture of your vote or something like that?
No, the easiest way to do it is with an absentee ballot.
Of course. See how naive I am.
and it was pretty shocking, I thought. And so, no, it wasn't that long ago.
And it could still be happening.
It could still happen.
But not at the voting booth.
Well, there are various ways they could try to mess with things. The good news is there are so many layers of protection. In Ohio, particularly, everything in the elections is done with a Democrat and a Republican doing it together. So you really have to have a bipartisan conspiracy. And I just don't believe in bipartisan conspiracies. And we'll catch them. That's the difference.
Have you noticed a decrease in faith in voter guides produced by news organizations?
I think a little bit, because lots of organizations, not news organizations, but lobbying organizations put out.
Like the NRA or that kind of thing.
Yeah, put out newsletters and ask questions of candidates. But the questions they ask are very often in the sort of the wording like, have you stopped beating your wife?
Right, leading questions, yeah.
And so they get them all thrown together in people's minds. And we don't do that. We ask questions. But we usually ask questions on issues that they may have to deal with and ask, what is your opinion, or what would you do about maybe immigration or something? And try very hard to make them even a fair question. We want to know their opinions on things, but try not to lead them.
Right. How much of a reach do you think you have into younger generations of voters? And how much of a role? I mean, they're going to be the majority. The millennials are outnumber baby boomers now.
We're working on it. It's a week. I'm not good at social media. But fortunately, we have some people who are. And we are working with things like Facebook and Twitter to get the same information that we do for the newspapers or the radio or television. We try to get that same kind of information onto the into social media.
We were talking earlier about how back in the olden days, you know, if you were lucky enough to have three channels on your TV set, everybody was sort of watching the same three stations, right? And so we were all coming to the dinner table or to the water cooler at work or whatever euphemism you want to be for the community conversation with the same basic information. And I'm wondering how you think, because of the proliferation of just options for news, whatever you want to call it, fake or not, how that's changed things.
Oh, it's much tougher, I think, now to get people's attention. It's not a problem with older people who are used to getting the newspaper, the radio, listening to this program, so forth. But it's much more difficult to get young people's attention. However, I think this year they are, the election certainly caught young people's attention. And then they ended up saying, where can I get some more information about this? Our membership has increased enormously.
Oh, good.
Oh, yes. I was just stunned. We had State House Day a few weeks ago, and about a third of the people there were brand new and very young.
Good news. Peg Rosenfield, yay you.
Mm-hmm. We were thrilled.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time as always.
Thank you for having me.
Peg Rosenfield, election specialist at the League of Women Voters of Ohio. Once again, just want to remind you that the League of Women Voters of Metropolitan Columbus has planned a forum on the topic of fake news for tonight. I'm one of the panelists, so if you join us, let me know that you're there because you heard it on the radio. I appreciate it. For more information, check out the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.